Get ready, golf lovers. The boys are teed up and ready to go. Backspin, thanks to Inside Golf.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Backspin, brought to you by Inside Golf, Australia's most read golfing publication. My name is Larry Canning. Gary Barter is sitting right next to me. Andrew Bunce is across the ocean of buttons, as we always refer to. We have a great show coming up, guys. Yeah. A little bit different. We're going to be talking to Mike Harwood. Now, given we've just watched the Open finishing this morning, we thought it best to get the guy that ran second at that same golf course to earn back a finish in Mike Harwood. So Mike's coming on the show, going to be talking about lots of things. Talking to Mike's always interesting because he says it how it is. He just doesn't really care much for chit-chat. He's a straight shooter, just like his golf game. 10 under par, Ryan Fox. Now, who would have picked him at the beginning of the week? I'm not sure I would have.
I picked him. He was one of my picks for the US Open because he came in form from Canada,
okay,
playing well. His stats looked amazing, but I'm disappointed I didn't pick him. I'd love to say I did.
What about the way he played that last hole? It doesn't get any better than that, does it? It's gritty, isn't it?
Oh, just the way he played the four birdies the last six holes.
Mm.
He hit like an amazing shot into 15, the par three, and got very unlucky, ricocheted into the bunker, had to play it backwards. His temperament looked incredible. He looked quite relaxed. He was walking down the fairway, talking to radar late in the round on Sky Sports. Just the grit and the insight into what's required to actually win a major. You could see a lot of the other players are seeing the enormity of the occasion because it is life-changing. And it does really put you into another stratosphere to win a major in your career. And 39 years of age, the way he got it in the clubhouse, and he said to his caddy as they teed off the last, "We're going to hit driver and I want to take it on and I'll deal with the consequences. If I hit it in a bunker or hit it in the rough, I don't want to, you know, hit an iron and then hope for a par and then maybe get in a playoff." So his intention was to win the golf tournament, and the 9-iron he hit into the last and then the putt. And he said something that I sort of enjoyed. He said, "Look, we always practice. I've got this putt to win a major." But he said, "Until you get to do it," he said, "I was like shaking." He said so. And he said, "I just hit the putt." And on the footage, you know, when we were watching it, the angle that they were showing us wasn't a great angle. We saw this angle from afar, from 12 feet. But then I did see later on the angle that the ball went in, and it was one bobble from missing.
Yeah.
It was like when Cam Smith won. I just felt so happy for him. You could feel sorry for Sam Burns, who's been very close, but he just couldn't hit the shots when they were required to be hit. He did step up toward the end, but in the middle of the round, when it was his tournament to win, he just couldn't step up.
It's getting harder for him to win a major, right?
As we know, the more misses, you'd think, well, you know, it'll be his time. You don't get that many chances. You get so many few chances, or so few chances. So
he's a complete player. To be able to take that golf course on and work his way around that, having played most of his golf in America, we've seen him in US Opens, which are the direct opposite sort of golf course to that, aren't they? So he's a complete player, isn't he? He can play any golf course, clearly.
Well, he's won America. He's won all around the world. You know, so now Michael Campbell, US Open champion, Lydia Ko, major champion, Bob Charles, 1963 British Open or Open Championship, Ryan Fox now Open Champion. Just incredible legacy for him. His dad being, a legend with the All Blacks.
Yeah, I don't think he's referred to as Grant's son anymore. I think Grant is Ryan's father now. I think that's he's put the reverse on that.
Like 39 years of age, he's definitely been a late bloomer. He said he's been a pro
25. He turned pro at 25.
Yeah, 15 years. He said in his second year, his dad was caddying for him. He'd missed the cut badly at the Australian PGA. He had like the final event, the Australian Masters, and he just, at that point, he wasn't enjoying it. He didn't know if he was going to keep pursuing golf. And his father said, "Why do you play this game?" And he said, "Well, I play to enjoy the game, but I'm not enjoying it." And he said, "Well, how about this week at the Masters? We just go down and enjoy it." And he said, "I finished fifth." And
kept his card. He was going to lose his card.
And that was the catalyst for him continuing on. But his golf swing, it reminds me of Arnold Palmer. It's a throwback. It's so physical. He's such a big body. And when you look at that swing in slow-mo, honestly, if I did that, I'd be in St. Vincent's Hospital.
Yeah.
you look at that golf swing and how mobile.
It's a wonder the golf club doesn't hit him.
And he's such.
Hit his body.
Oh, my God.
Or
he's such a great driver of the golf ball.
It's a bullet fade, isn't it? He's strong.
He just hammers it. And he was in the fairway bunker on 18 in round three.
How good was that shot?
Like that shot, there'd be three players in the world that could hit that shot. And then Cameron Young was in the same bunker today and hit the lip. And Cam Young went out early. He got the best of it. The wind started to pick up. And when I was watching the footage and I'm watching Cam Young on the range getting ready for a playoff and Ryan hit it in that bunker and chip out backwards on 15, I got to tell you, the odds of Cam Young winning at that point, you'd think he was a laydown Mazaire. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a golf swing, guys. Cam Young, another unusual swing. I mean, it's
almost paused at the top.
Technically, pretty sound, I know, but that's a almost pause. I reckon that is a pause.
Yeah,
I'm going to give that a pause.
Yeah, like a Matsuyama.
More pause than Matsuyama.
And Cam Young hits it so far, and he's not a huge guy. Like, I don't know if he'd be 6 foot, but solid build.
But one of the better strikers. I mean, he's
Oh my god. Yeah, just incredible player.
Lucas Herbert, mate. What do you make of Lucas's back nine, really, wasn't it? He did get to the lead, didn't he, during the course of the back nine?
Again, he's stepped up, hasn't he? He's always been talented.
Did you see that shot he played yesterday, the third round, on the par five? I think it was 17, when he took an unplayable lie, and it looked like it was a punch out from where he was. At best, you know, maybe get it over the bunker in front and hit a medium iron in. He knocked it on the green, nearly hit the flag. It was the greatest shot of that tournament, I reckon, at a time when he was leaking some oil too. He missed a few fairways.
Yeah.
Then there's another golf swing, guys, worth discussing. A lot of moving parts.
Yeah, they're all throwbacks. And even if you throw Scottie Scheffler in there, you look at that. So all these so-called technically, aesthetically beautiful swings, if you look at the guys that are at the highest level at the moment, they're pretty commercial, aren't they?
Siwoo Kim had a chance, obviously.
Yeah, he's got a great golf swing.
He's going to win, isn't he? He's going to win something big. He's gutsy.
Well, he's won the Players' Championship. It was a really good tournament. Really, the only thing that I felt watching it over the 4 days, it was unusual to watch a British Open with so many mid-irons just hitting and stopping within 2 yards.
Yeah.
You don't see that bounce out.
Out of the rough.
Yeah, you don't see that bounce out. It wasn't that exacting off the tee. You know, they were talking about that on the commentary quite a lot. But the golf course, two par fives right at the end.
Interesting layout, isn't it?
Yeah, interesting layout. So it looked like they all had to get going early, get their rounds going. If they didn't take advantage of those early holes, they were going to find it tough.
It'll be interesting to talk to Mike Harwood about that golf course. It has changed a little bit, but it's definitely a course that sort of suits some, I think, and not others. Rory McIlroy, a disappointing week for Rory, putted horrifically on Saturday, didn't he?
Scheffler couldn't make a putt. Brooks Koepka couldn't make a putt. Like, Brooks played really, really good golf. But drive for show, putt for dough.
Oh, I hate that corny cliche, Gaz. Please put that under the counter.
Well, that was
under the counter.
That's please. Exactly what it, Ryan, I think Fox led the putting for the week.
Yeah, yeah.
So
with an arm lock putter.
Mm.
Women's British Open on next week, Gaz, at Royal Lytham and St Anne's. So maybe we'll get an Aussie across the line there. We'll be back after this, Gaz, with Mike Harwood.
You're listening to Backspin with Larry Canning and Gary Barter.
We've got Mike Harwood on the line as we speak. Gaz, g'day, Mike. Welcome to Backspin.
Thank you, boys. Nice for you to give me a call.
We thought it appropriate, given we've just had the Open played at Birkdale, where you nearly won. You know, I've talked about this in the past. When you actually run second in a British Open in a major, is it just flat-out gutting? Is it inspiring? What are the feelings like?
I was probably, for the next month, I was down and got really just mentally silly calls when I was playing golf, you know, stupid decisions, and I was very disappointed that I didn't win, because normally when I play well, I do win, and that was probably the first time in a couple of years that, you know, things hadn't fallen my way, but I still played, you know, I played great first, you know, I played great every day. What is it like? It's a tough one. Definitely took me a month to get over it, and then stop feeling sorry for yourself, you just get on with it.
Obviously, two shots was the final score, but was there a point during the last couple of holes where you thought, if I just birdie this, or if I just make four there, or was it a case of if Finch, God forbid, three putts?
I had about a 6 footer on 15 for a birdie, and I hit a great putt and it lipped out. But then I birdied 16 on a really tough hole, and then 17 was a very easy par five, a lot easier than what it is now. And I probably hit my worst shot of the week. You know, I hit a drive, probably only went 230 yards off the tee, and I was left with I was still reachable, and then I hit an average second shot, you know, 15 yards short of the green, and the 17th green was the worst green on the golf course, and then, you know, tipped up a 6 foot pass and missed it. But no, look, I had plenty of chances, you know, but Ian just played too well. As simple as that. I mean, I played great golf and he played better.
Were you with Amira that last round?
No, I was with the legendary Eamon Darcy.
Oh, Eamon Darcy, were you? With the golf swing, the smooth swing, Darcy.
Yeah.
Did you know him very well, Mike?
I knew him very well. I would say in all my playing days, there's about two or three guys I don't enjoy playing with because they're just downright rude. and he's one of them. He leads the pack. Most Irish guys are fantastic, but something went wrong with him somewhere along the line.
He wins the Order of Merit.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a weirdo.
That was an amazing era that you played in, obviously Ballesteros, Faldo, Montgomery, Woosnam, just some amazing players, like Hall of Fame players.
Yes.
And I was just looking at your record. It's a pretty phenomenal record. Like, you won all the big ones in Europe, the European Open, Volvo Masters, European PGA Championship. And obviously, if you had have knocked off the Open, that would have been a clean sweep. Did you have any other chances in your career at the Open, or how did it pan out?
I'm pretty sure I played like 10 or 11 in a row until I sort of gave it away when I was mid-30s. Played 10 or 11. I think I was exempt 5 times and I had to qualify 5 times. And that was probably even a better record, is the fact that I actually, every time I went to qualify, which is approximately 5 times, I got through. And you're talking, 80 players for 5 spots each event, each time, and I got through every time. And that was probably even better, almost better than winning the race.
It was harder to qualify than to win it, you reckon?
Oh, mate, it was, some of the things I did in the qualifying, I think I shot 62 to make it by one shot 1 year.
Good God. It's interesting that we're talking to an Australian who has a European record probably as good as any, if not better than any other Australian, and he had to qualify.
It's interesting looking at the level of play in your career. And I saw last night you never got to play the Masters at Augusta.
No. Yeah. What do you think, Mike?
And to think, a lot of our great players haven't got to play the Masters. Like, looking at that, it's just wrong, isn't it? It's just crazy.
Yeah, well, it was a different category back then. I spoke to one of the guys from the Masters to ask him why he didn't get a spot. And he said, we'd like to have an international field and there's too many Australians in the field.
Yeah.
Was the sort of mentality back in those days.
We're talking a major. We're talking one of the 4 major championships. And you're ranked 20 in the world. And, there's too many other Aussies.
Yeah, well, there was. I think that particular year, I think there were like 6 or 7 Aussies in the top 20.
Yeah, okay.
That was just an incredible period of golf for Australian players. A little dominant across the world.
Would you say your game was suited to just tougher setups, stronger golf courses? Because I know that even in the time that I've spent travelling overseas the last 20 years, and obviously I'm with Matt Jones and watching the major championships, the course setups, it's another level that week, isn't it? Just the level of the pins.
Yeah.
I suppose how someone's game would get exposed in that environment.
Yeah.
It looks like your game, like winning at Valderrama, I saw when I was reading last night, just that golf course. Like, so would you say you had that game that was suited to those courses?
I would say when it came to Europe that courses were probably a little bit shorter in Europe than what they were in America at that time when I was playing well. I enjoyed the bounce. I enjoyed the run. I used to get a bit of a topspin fade, and I used to, used to run a long way on the hard ground. I played enough tournaments in the States, all over the States in the country, over there and up high, down south, every Florida. And I found having a swing which was pretty much, it was a home swing. It was my swing. It wasn't a pure golf swing. I was a little bit steep, and I found when I went and played in America, like up around Ohio, New York, where the courses were really, a lot of them were really soft, I was thinking the divots were too big, and I hit a lot of shots fat. Where when you play in Europe, the ground's a lot harder, and particularly on links courses, the club tends to sort of skip across the surface a little bit, like you're playing on that. And I just found that my swing was a little bit, it's sort of, the hardness of the ground helped be shallow the club face, as it's coming into the ball. So that was my theory behind it all. But I was a great driver of the ball, tight courses in Europe, and that suited my game because, I'd only miss, a couple of fairways a week. I wasn't a golfer that would take unnecessary risks. I like to do it over the 72 holes.
It's a great way to play, though, that low spin fade. Like, you look at Roger Davis had that, didn't he?
Yeah.
He hit it so far. Parry had that. Just from your own swing, your own way of playing. So when you started as a kid, were you one of the phenomenal amateurs, or were you obviously you did a traineeship? Were you always a standout at every level?
I wasn't. I always had an ability. I was a member of Bayview, which was a great place to learn short game, and I always had a great short game, and that was all the way through my career.
If you look at the career you've had, was it just something you just developed? Ryan Fox, he alluded to it a bit last night because I was talking about him being a late bloomer, and he was saying, look, I had to learn my trade. I wasn't this
Absolutely.
Amazing amateur golfer. He said I was probably a couple of tournaments in my second year of almost giving it away.
And that was very, the best thing I played till I started my apprenticeship was I played pennants for Bayview, and I had a good record there. Look, I always had a good ability to shoot low numbers because I had a great short game, And that sort of was the whole way through my career. You know, many tournaments I'd shoot, you know, something like 372s, and then I'd shoot a 64 or a 65. Certainly wasn't a Greg Norman style golfer who could just blow the field away. I didn't have that talent. I certainly didn't have that mental side of the game where you could just be totally aggressive. You know, 72 holes, that wasn't me. I like to sort of play within myself.
And you've come through the era of the Bellata ball, the wooden heads. You've moved into, you know, you've still won 58 times at senior level. You're now...
You're 58 times.
Yeah, I just looked at it last. He said some like 79 world wins, 5 times in Europe, you know, 3 or 4 times in Australia. Then obviously you've won the big Australian Senior Championship, Australian PG Senior Championship. You've won at all levels right through. And obviously you're playing today. Yeah, you know, we're interviewing you before you tee off today. And now you're using the absolute modern equipment. What adjustments have you made? Have you felt that it's so much easier now than back in the day, or is it just
I would say I remember when the metal driver first came out, that was probably the start of my downfall because I didn't have the swing speed. You know, the driver didn't go any further for me.
Yep.
Even it was, you know, like 4 or 5 inches longer, it just still flew 240 yards and that was it.
Oh, okay.
And then what happened after that was up to the, you know, it was up to the conditions. And I tried every driver and they're all the same. Nothing changed. The balls were the same. I mean, I used to use the Maxfly ball. Probably that was a little bit better back in those days. But yeah, no, the changing in of the equipment never really changed my game at all, whereas it certainly did for a lot of other people.
I always reckon it was just made the fields deeper. The people who don't have the ability can access the newer gear and actually ride, their game rises. Like a bloke like Mike Harwood who hits it out of the centre every time, wouldn't matter if you could turn a golf club round, hit it with a grip, and hard to hit it down the centre.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I knew when I went out and played, particularly for, you know, like a 4-year period, I knew I had the best set of golf clubs in the field. I spent a lot of time over in Japan at the Mizuno factory, and the equipment I got over there, very similar to probably what Nick Faldo was getting. It was just the best stuff. Everything was pure.
Okay.
You know, all the head weights were exact. Whereas, you know, back in those days, guys could have clubs that were, you know, D3s and D5s and D1s all over the shop, where mine were absolutely perfect.
And so you talk about your short game, and you would have played a lot with Ballesteros over the years. What would you say about his game, his short game compared to yours, or just generally?
Probably he had more imagination. I think when you talk about short game, he's like 8-iron to, you know, sand wedge. It was phenomenal.
Yep.
The courses were a lot shorter then, so he's obviously had such a great short game. That's why he was so dominant in those years, because the golf courses were shorter in Europe. He was special.
What about Rummy?
Did you play with Seve a lot?
I did. I probably played with him a dozen times.
Okay. What sort of character? Was he intimidating? Was he?
Mate, I'll tell you a story. He was a lovely, lovely man off the golf course. Very intimidating on the golf course. It was all about him on the golf course, no question about that. We're sitting in the locker room just before that last round of the British Open where I finished second, and I was putting my shoes on. He was putting his shoes on just, you know, near me, and they'll talk about me on the BBC. And someone said on the TV, "Oh, what do you think about Mike Harwood's chances today?" And before they said anything, Savvy said, "Mike who?"
Are you serious?
So that was a nice start to the day.
He was taking the piss, right?
Well, I don't know. What are you doing, mate? That wasn't very nice. Something you wouldn't go there, would you?
No, you wouldn't touch that. No.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But, so it's very competitive. I mean, there's lots of stories about him, you know, and they are very true. There's lots of people didn't like him.
Yeah.
But off the golf course, he was a super guy.
One of the stories I've heard that he might have been not cheating or anything, but he stretched the rules out about as far as he could, and he would do his best to talk a rules official into a rule that would favour him.
Absolutely, he would totally try to intimidate the rules officials, but they knew that.
Yeah, okay.
Which Bryson couldn't do.
Sorry?
What do you make of DeChambeau?
Well, there's 500 TV cameras these days.
Did you see the incident?
Look, I tried to Google it, and it wouldn't come through. Someone had stopped the video from, you know, from going around. But no, I didn't see it.
It was not good.
Did it look bad?
No, it didn't look good at all, yeah.
Yeah, well, for anyone to say that he was trying to cheat or do the wrong thing is totally out of line. These guys don't do that. They make mistakes, like Tiger did a few years ago, the Masters, when they took the drop.
Yeah, yeah.
They just make a mistake, or they had a mad moment, or they weren't thinking, or I just hope people don't try to call him a cheat.
Yeah, and Xander Schauffele, he said exactly what you said. He said that. Radar on Sky Sports, Wayne Riley for the listeners. Radar said, look, there was no camera directly behind the ball. Very difficult to judge and make that call. The only thing that looked ordinary is when Bryson walked in and he made some big sort of heavy clumping steps. It was like he was the first man on the moon.
Yeah.
Behind the pearl.
No, but in saying that, there's been a plethora of stuff on the internet. And one thing that I found interesting was that when he did strike the ball, the angle of attack the club came down was nowhere near the supposed clumped down grass, even if it wasn't clumped down. In other words, if you draw a line on the screen, even if the grass was in its original position, the club wouldn't have touched it anyway. Now, I think he was arguing the fact that he was called in later after the round to explain himself in front of the two officials. He said that when these supposed actions of him, you know, walking in with pretty heavy steps, he wasn't even sure which way he was going to play the ball yet.
Right.
And that's when, you know, I sort of think what Radar said, there was no camera behind. It was interesting because then there's other footage of Wyndham Clark at the US Open, which is pretty damning footage. When he made some practice swings near his ball, which he would normally do. And then he walked over and put his foot down behind his ball and made practice swings on the other side of the ball. Yeah. And then he walked back.
A lot of the time you do, when you look at your lie, you know, analyse your lie, you do look around you to go and see where somewhere is similar, and you have a few swings in there just to get a feel for what's going to happen. And that's what I thought. But I did see that incident from Wyndham, and it just didn't look right.
I think that's what let Bryson down at the end of the day. They say it just didn't pass the pub test in just the way it looked.
Yeah. But maybe Bryson's penalty was a combination of people thinking maybe they let Cameron Young go, the other guy, get off.
Yeah,
maybe they just didn't want to go down the same track again.
So talk about Birkdale. Michael, is it, you played 10 Open, so is it, I'm going to ask you, is it your favourite British Open golf course, but with you?
No.
Okay.
No. Muirfield's definitely, I would have thought, number one. Muirfield's beautiful. Fantastic.
Tougher than Birkdale?
Yes, a lot tougher than Birkdale. Birkdale's very short. You know, when it's dry like it was, it's very short. Yeah. I mean, even I was hitting wedges into, you know, 2-3. It was just, the front nine was a snack.
Right.
If you got it in play. But I know they had lengthened it.
I think they only lengthened it 70 yards, didn't they?
I played there about 10 years ago, and I reckon there was at least 7 or 8 tees that had gone 30, 40 yards.
Oh, okay. I'm with you.
Okay.
And it was brutal. You can get on a run. I mean, you look, I think, you know, did Ryan Fox only made the cut by 1 or 2 shots, didn't he?
And that's
the thing. Same as Finchie. I think Finchie made the cut on the line. And it's that sort of course. You can go out in the morning and get on a run, you know, and shoot your 7 or 8 under, and then the field in the afternoon and get the sea breeze, and then you're lucky to, you know, shoot even par. It becomes so difficult. So it's certainly a golf course where you make the cut and the weather conditions do what they normally do. You can make a massive run at the field from the bottom end.
Where are you playing today, mate?
I'm at a beautiful downtown Bogarra today.
Okay. So just is it a senior pro-am?
Yeah, it is a senior pro-am, and it's blowing the gust of 60 kilometres an hour.
You're kidding.
And it's overcast and it's grizzly.
60k an hour, I'm going straight to the TAB. Harwood, me.
Well, yeah, I'm not far behind you. I'm thinking if it's the same tomorrow, I might sleep in.
You still must love playing golf.
Mate, I think this is it for me. The next 3 to 4 weeks will be it for me.
You reckon?
Yeah.
We'll hold you to that. We'll get you one in 3 or 4 weeks and ask the same question.
I might play the odd one in Melbourne, but no, my days, I've exhausted every possible thing.
You reckon?
I've had enough, put it that way. It's time to take up lawn bowls.
When you were playing in Europe, did you play a lot with Faldo? And I want to hear your opinion of that, Blake.
I played with Nick probably half a dozen times. Another guy who's just a best bloke off the golf course. On the golf course, just very similar to myself, really. I'm happy to play 18 holes and not talk to anyone.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know,
off the course, he's all right, you reckon?
Oh, fantastic guy. Yeah, so really? Funny. Yeah.
Jeez, you don't hear... Funny bloke.
Yeah, funny bloke.
You don't hear that, Mike. From me, I've never heard anyone say that about him.
Yeah, no, he's got a... Well, he's pretty big. He was pretty good on TV for a long time.
Yeah, he was. Well.
No, if you spoke to all the blokes that work with him on TV, Finchie and Frank Nobilo, they all say the same thing. He's a really funny bloke off the course.
Yeah, okay, interesting.
You've got a split personality.
You're disappointed, aren't you?
I am gutted.
What What do you want me to say?
We'd
like to pry out the top five of when you were talking about
Eamon Darcy,
yeah, and there was a five in there. Just name another one you might not have liked to be drawn.
Because Rory came out and said that he didn't like Bryson.
Oh, big time, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting.
So, Mike, give us one more you dislike.
Russell Clayton.
Oh, okay.
Remember that big guy? I think he weighed about 250 kilos.
Yeah, he played in Australia, didn't he? He played in the Masters in Australia.
Yeah, he did too. Yeah, yeah, no. He was let's just say rude.
Right, okay.
Yeah, he was one of those stuck-up poms. I shouldn't say that, should I?
No.
That's a terrible thing to say, but that's exactly what I was trying to get you to say.
No, he's driving a taxi in London now, so he's got one.
Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, mate. Thank you for being part of Backspin. Surely you're getting sick of hearing the most underrated Australian golfer. Are you sick of that yet?
Don't care.
That's hard, isn't it?
Hey.
Don't care.
You know what? Look at his record.
Yeah. Oh, I do. And I look at it.
And all I'll finish on saying, boys, they often say no one ever remembers someone who can finish second. Well, you phoned me this morning, so thanks, boys. You do remember.
We remember. Good on you, Mike. Thanks, mate. Play well today.
See you, mate.
Thank you.
Cheers, bye. Mate.
Golf never sounded this good. You're listening to Backspin with Larry and Gary, thanks to Inside Golf.
As we referred to the interview Rory McIlroy made about Bryson, we actually have a tape of that. We'll play it now.
Well, if I ask your opinion on the Bryson Rules incident last night, a few different players have been in with different interpretations of it. What did you see?
So I was watching it live. I was up in the players' lounge watching it with a few other players, and as soon as he made the step into the ball, we all sort of looked at each other and were like, that didn't seem right. And then when I heard that he was... You know, he was called in by the rules officials. I think it was pretty obvious for why. I think, you know, I think there's no doubt that he improved the line of his backswing. So, you know, and again, it's like whether it was careless or whether it was intentional, I don't think it matters. Hopefully it was careless. But I think the two-shot penalty was justified for sure.
What do you think of the scenes after? Obviously, you guys were delayed getting your tea times as well because of it all going on.
Late night for everyone. I won't pretend to be up here and defend Bryson. I'm not particularly fond of him. I think a lot of it's performative. I think a lot of it's for attention. And to hold the tournament hostage like that and have all of us, volunteers, players, everyone waiting on him to depart, I didn't feel like it was a great look.
Do you think he knew what he was doing?
Look, he's going to say, like, again, I'm not in his mind, but it didn't look good.
Boy, is something like that, you think that happens out here more than we know, and it just isn't viewed or seen? Or...
Yeah, it's hard, right? Like, he's every shot is on camera. There's a lot of guys that play this week and the shots aren't on camera, so you can say that that's unfair or whatever, or it might happen more than it does, but it's obviously impossible to police everyone, and that's why it is a, you know, for the most part, a self-policing game. But I think when there is obvious evidence like there was last night, then obviously that's a different story.
You'd have to think that Rory and Bryson don't catch up down at the local pub very often.
I can't imagine it. They would not be having a Guinness.
Remember the Masters when Bryson was interviewed after, the Masters that he won, about how he'd hadn't spoken to him, and it's come from that dislike of the guy. It's interesting that Rory, well, he's one of those guys that just says what's on his mind, but he's measured and really a great communicator. I mean, he's been doing it since he was, you know, chipping golf balls into a washing machine when he was barely higher than a washing machine. But he does speak well, but it's always, you know, he does have opinions, and that's a pretty strong one to say, isn't it? He's going to draw this guy again at some point very soon, isn't he?
Just human beings. Not everyone gets on with everybody.
Yeah.
And they're in an environment, very competitive environment. You know, obviously the best, in the top probably five best players in the world. They've got that combative, but also on a personal level, I suppose, you know, Rory and Bryson just don't align. And He said it publicly, which is interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Normally, you wouldn't go flat out and say, I'm not fond of him.
It's not like they're going into a boxing ring or a tennis court or something and bashing something at each other. They're gentlemen walking off the first tee after shaking hands and saying, good luck.
Well, the gentleman's game is very competitive. I even say to all the young guys that I coach, even though we don't play a sport that's head-to-head combat, it's not sort of high arousal like tennis one-on-one or rugby league. The really, really great golfers, when they're on that first tee, they are very, very competitive.
Yeah.
They're not running into each other, but mentally, as Mike said, you know, he would shake the guy's hand at the start of the round, but wouldn't want to talk to him. Faldo wouldn't want to talk to you during the round. You know, because they're ultimately, when they step on that tee, they're very, very competitive.
Faldo, a good bloke. Nah.
I got to tell you, in the times that I've seen him, he's been really, really chatty, really, really...
Yeah, but you like Patrick really Reed.
Patrick Reed's really good. Bryson's really good. As Mike said, we're not seeing them inside the ropes. I'm seeing them in the locker room, or I'm seeing them at a player dining or on the practice range. But yeah, when they step on that tee, there obviously can be that fine line between being competitive and rude or arrogant or selfish or, yeah, whatever. But Rory, not a fan.
We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Backspin with Larry Canning and Gary Barter.
Feeling hungry for a tasty tip? Here it is.
Gaz, it's tip time, and as usual, you're beautifully prepared, aren't you?
No.
The tip I'm going to suggest you respond to, Gaz, is that I've regripped my clubs. They're called Golf Pride Plus 4 grips, which means there are 4 extra papers. We always measure the thickness of a grip by how many papers we put under them. You and I have done that a million times. But these grips come with a thicker, more parallel...
Under the right hand.
Under the right hand. Yeah, the second half of the grip. So my right hand and left hand grip, in the normal grip, it tapers away quite dramatically. I'm getting some issues with my right hand. I've got a little thing it needs operating on. It feels way, way better for me to have these grips on. And I'm actually finding I'm hitting the ball a little better with them, able to control the face a little more, particularly the short stuff, the wedges and stuff. Grips, the way we hold the club is often something that's overlooked until you see an extreme example of a really funky grip. And we saw that with Jackson Suber, who was leading the Open after a couple of rounds or into the second round. And his grip, Gaz, you have seen it, right? Have you ever seen a grip that weird before? And if you did see a grip like that with a young bloke, would you change it?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I started golf, I came from cricket. And holding the cricket bat, when I held onto a golf club, my grip looked like Jackson Suber's grip. Exactly the same. But of course, you know, you go and get golf tuition and you learn how to hold the grip technically correct. And I think pretty much...
Was Ron Luxton your coach back then?
No, it was Bill McWilliam was my first coach.
Big on grips, was he, on the way you held the club?
But Ronnie was obviously very pro-grip. You know, the classic sort of two knuckles on the left hand... Yeah, the V on the right hand with the forefinger and the thumb across the top of the grip. Even the Victory Pride grips back in the day, they had a little drawing on there.
They did.
That you'd follow. It looked like a fishtail on the right hand. And then you look at Tom Watson came along, like four-knuckle left-hand grip, but then virtually a weak right-hand grip to neutralise that. But you look at Jackson Suber's grip, that'd be the most aggressive, strong grip that you would see. So both hands turned way to the left.
Looks like
he'd see four or five knuckles on the left hand, and his right hand's right under the golf club.
Looks like his club's hit an electric fence and got stuck on it.
Yeah, obviously that's referred to as a strong grip because it feels really strong. Now, if you swing, if you would call technically correct through the ball, you would hook the ball badly with that grip. But like anything, he's employed some conditions in his swing to be able to get the club face back to square. So if you've got a strong left-hand grip, you've got to really cup your left wrist.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you had a weak left-hand grip, like a Lather Bowl had a one-knuckle grip. Yeah. But it's all about matching up the wrist condition to the grip that you've got so that through the golf ball, you mentioned to me that Suber doesn't close the face through the ball. So he releases the club underneath.
Yep.
He's employing conditions to suit that grip. It's just one of those things where you've got to get advice. But in answer to your question, I don't normally look at somebody straight away and think they've got to change their grip. But I do think the younger you are and you've got time and you want to go down the path of being more technically correct, which you'd suggest. Like we look at Siwoo Kim, we look at Tommy Fleetwood, we look at these great swings. But you've definitely got to have a grip that's suited to your swing. So that's...
It's like the chicken or the egg, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got to be able to manage. It's like if Dustin Johnson came along to you with that shut face at the top and the bowed left wrist, Butch Harmon made the call with him that, well, he's got to fade the ball with those conditions. Mm. He can't really try to draw the ball from there.
Because it'll hook too much.
Exactly. So you've got to make the call. Do you get a young Dustin Johnson or a young Craig Parry and you go down the path of changing the grip, but then you've got to change the swing? If they've gone too far and they've got to that older age, it's very hard to do the both.
Does the older you get, is there a time when you would change your grip if you were getting like to my age? Just to improve some sort of ball flight? Or
again, it'd be to do with you, the way you set the club, your wrist conditions during the backswing, which is obviously difficult to explain on a podcast, but that's when you got your advice of your PGA pro. But I get members or visitors that come along and I've just got to explain to them that, look, it's no good complaining to me that you're hitting a snap hook. And I'll say, either got to look at changing your grip or the way that you take the club back and set your wrists. So there's no doubt about it that sometimes it's easy to change the grip.
Mm.
Most people, as you know, you've done a lot of teaching and you change their grip.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
They don't book in with you again.
They don't even talk to you. They don't sometimes don't pay.
So it's about managing it. And getting back to the way we started this, and you talked about the four papers under your right hand, that does help people to neutralize that wrist condition through impact. Mm, yeah. So I've always, you know, from day one, I've always put one paper under the left and two under the right.
Yeah,
I've always liked the feeling of the grip because I started with leather grips that were pretty...
Jesus, you're old.
Yeah, I am. You can still get them.
Aussie grips.
Yeah, and they're definitely more cylindrical the whole way down.
In fact, I think Lucas Herbert might have been using them just in the open.
Yeah.
Thanks, Gaz. That's us for the podcast, Gary. Thank you, Mike Arlett, for being part of the show. Thank you, listeners, for listening, and we'll be back very, very soon.